Hello, I'm Goldie Sayers, Olympic medalist, and back to the EIS Insider, the podcast from the English Institute of Sport that lifts the lid on the science behind peak performance. And today's episode is all about sleep. A snooze, a doze, a catnap, whatever you call it, we all do it. Some of us more successfully than others, it has to be said. But on average, we spend a third of our lives sleeping. So why is it that we often pay so little attention to getting it right? Well, those sleepless nights are over, because in this podcast, we'll find out some of the secrets to a good night's kip. We'll discover why it's time to wake up to the importance of sleep, and we'll get some tips on how to slumber more soundly. I love a good night's sleep, but when I was an athlete, one of the things I disliked most about competing was getting to sleep the night before a major championships. I also remember being told, to alleviate my fear of not sleeping, that 72 hours sleep deprivation does not impact physical performance, which I found quite comforting. But was my coach spinning me a yarn? What is the reality? How much sleep do we really need? And how do we go about getting it? And how can it help our performance? To answer these questions and many more, I've got some warm milk on the go. I've climbed into my PJs and dimmed the lights to chat to Luke Gupta, Senior Project Physiologist at the EIS. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Goldie.
And Laura Needham, Joint Head of Physiology at the EIS. Hi, Laura.
Hi, yeah. How are you doing?
Great. Well, actually not fantastic. Full disclosure here. I was at an event last night and had to get up very early this morning. So I didn't sleep particularly well last night. How about you two? Are you raring to go, or are you struggling for a bit of a weary night like mine?
Well, Luke's got a new puppy, so I imagine he's probably not having the best sleep at the moment. Whereas my dog's 9, so I'm fine.
Yeah, I'm sort of getting used to it now. I complained on the first few nights, but now I'm just like, yeah, it's part of it. So just cracking on, really.
So can you get used to not having enough sleep?
You can. It's a good thing, because if you didn't, then it wouldn't be a very good mechanism, really, to make sleep work, because we all have to function to some extent, whether you slept or not. And sort of the more you get used to not sleeping well, the more you have this ability to sort of basically get through the day. But it's bad, obviously, because you can become a little bit immune to those signs and symptoms of that your sleep's not quite right. So for a few nights or a few weeks, it's okay. But if you sort of did that for months or even years, then you might just think, oh, this is normal for me. And you kind of get a bit too used to it. So yeah, short and long term, good and bad.
Okay, we'll definitely dig into that later on. But Laura, what does a physiologist do, and how does sleep come into being a physiologist?
So at the EIS, kind of when we talk about physiology, we talk about kind of our practitioners working immersed in performance teams within the sports. And they're really kind of exploring the limits of human performance. They're really trying to help athletes and coaches kind of, you know, what is the edge, and how do we go to the Olympics and Paralympics and all those major championships and win games? And what we're really interested in is how the body responds to kind of exercise and a stress that we'd put on the body. So we do an interval session, for example, and that's a huge physiological stress. We're looking to challenge the human body so it actually adapts. And when we're talking about adaptation, what we want the body to do is kind of go, oh, we don't, you know, if that happens again, we want to be better prepared for it. So it will kind of have a super compensation and basically try and make yourself stronger. And when we talk about sleep, and Luke will be able to touch a lot more on this, it's a restorative process, and it basically rebuilds and repairs all the damage that we do during the day. So that's why it's so important for us, because that's our biggest kind of recovery tool we have in the bag.
So really, when an athlete is sleeping, that's when all the gains are made from all the training they've done throughout the day.
Absolutely. And I think that's what we probably don't give it enough credit for. And obviously that's in combination with all other aspects like nutrition, for example. It's kind of, it's not just the one thing, but it's a huge part. You know, like you mentioned at the start, we spend a third of our life doing this. And we know very little about it, I suppose, and we don't pay attention to it. And it's definitely something we've focused on at the Institute over the last kind of, especially with kind of Luke's PhD that he did over the last, what's 10 years now, isn't it, Luke?
10 years. That's quite scary.
He's very much an expert. And we, you know, and from Luke's work, that's where kind of I'm a practitioner as well. And I take his learnings and I work with the athletes on the ground to actually kind of what he finds and help put it into practice to kind of optimise that period while you're sleeping.
And Luke, coming to your PhD, PhD, were you using that heavily with the work you did? I know you worked quite closely with all the athletes leading up and during the Tokyo Games. What were you kind of there to do, and how did you help them out there?
Yeah, so I basically translated sort of sleep management packages, which have been well rehearsed, well used in different worlds, like clinical management of sleep disorders. And then I basically brought that into sport and sportified, is that a word? Sportified it in a way where athletes sort of can understand it and digest it and actually put these things into practice. So obviously Tokyo provided a lot of different challenges, which might have not been there if it weren't for a pandemic, but nonetheless, those sort of management techniques around, as you described at the start of this podcast, night before competition, long haul travel, many others are sort of typical challenges to sleep. So my job really was to sort of help athletes on the ground, like putting these interventions into practice. But they've done it like 100 times before this event. So it wasn't like it was a brand new thing for them. It's just sort of as they're going into it, as they're going along the way of their Olympic journey, once they're in Tokyo, how do they sort of put it into practice? How do they react to certain things that crop up they might not have expected? And just to make sure, not they slept well every night, because that's quite an unrealistic expectation. As much as that sounds like a brilliant thing for a sleep person to say, it was more to sort of manage their expectations around sleep. So understand that you're not going to sleep well every single night. You're in probably one of the most stressful environments of your career, and be comfortable with not sleeping well, which is quite a difficult message to give some people, but it does go a long way when you sort of get to that point. So yeah, mixture of sort of applied practice of things to do, but also a lot of like messaging, making people feel a bit more comfortable and normalizing sleep disruption.
So that quote I gave you, that a coach said to me around 72 hours sleep deprivation doesn't affect physical performance, it obviously affects mental performance, I think. So is that true, or was my coach talking rubbish to comfort me? I mean, it certainly helped me. So it sounds similar to what you're saying.
It's similar. I probably couldn't quote the actual exact number of hours of not sleeping. It'd probably be different in every single person, and it would depend on what your event is the next day. So if you've got a more cognitively demanding performance or sport, then that will look different to say if you've just got an event like shot put, where you just got to throw something heavy. I'm probably doing shot put a real big disservice there by saying that.
Yeah, careful.
Yeah, it's very easy. Javelin's way harder. So that's interesting. So actually, sleep can affect different events more heavily. So are you working kind of much harder with a team sport, maybe, where there's decision making involved?
Yeah, to some extent. So you've got the sport itself, which team sports is a great one because it has everything, really. It's got the physical, the cognitive, it's tactical, and a coach also needs to sleep and make all those good decisions and sort of function well on the sideline. So it is a lot more complicated. So I've done a lot of work with team sports, and with team sports, they have a lot more, arguably a lot more challenges around the tournament itself. So fixtures are not at the same time of day every single day. Sometimes they're early in the morning, sometimes they're late at night. You have travel to these different places all over the world. And again, even the positional demands of a team will likely be affected by sleep in different ways. So the more you talk about it, the more it gets very complicated. But it does affect team sports and individual sports differently. So we know that individual athletes tend to get more affected by or sleep worse before competitions, more so than team sport athletes, which is interesting. When you're an individual athlete and you're not on your game, it's basically that person sort of on their own out there doing it. There's no sort of other team players that can sort of come in and sort of get them through that performance.
Are some sports better at sleeping than others?
That would be an amazing thing to look into. I think, yeah, you could argue there's certain characteristics of certain sports that make them better sleepers than others. So for example, we know that older people don't sleep as well as younger people. We know that females sleep poorer than males generally. So if you're a sport which encompasses older females, then arguably they're going to sleep worse than those who are not like that. But also training schedules play into this. If you're a sport that demands an early get-up time, you're not going to get as much sleep, arguably, in some people who might take part in a sport where training might start at midday, for example. So yeah, the characteristics of a sport, not dictate, but they highly influence what sleep looks like in a certain person. We're not at a stage in sport, and I don't think we'll ever get there, where we actually take into consideration people's sleep profiles and say, right, this is what you look like as a sleeper. Let's design a training program that's aligned to that. And if you could do that, will you get additional benefits to performance? That'd be a brilliant thing to do, wouldn't it?
That's the next 10 years of your life. Don't worry.
But that's not the real world. But yeah, the idea is quite nice. If you could do that, you probably would get better sleep and you probably would get better performance in theory.
So going back to the beginning, Laura, why is sleep so important for athletes?
Not only is it important for athletes, it's important for everyone. If we don't sleep, we die.
Okay.
It's that important. And actually for our athletes, you know, you can tell when, you know, when you've had a bad night's sleep, and if it's been a few times, you're grumpy, you feel exhausted, you know, your appetite might be a bit out. And all of those things when you're an elite athlete are so important to performance, because all of these little things add up. And sleep for me, when you see the kind of detriments of poor sleep and the kind of effect that has on the holistic lifestyle that an athlete needs to lead, that's when you start to come into trouble, when it's not in the right place it should be.
And Luke, you mentioned obviously not sleeping well is to perhaps be predicted and expected at an Olympic Games. And obviously I mentioned, you know, dreading that night before a qualifying round where you know you've got to perform at 9 a.m. so therefore get up at 5 a.m. and being, you know, dreading that night before the sleep that you may or may not get. So is one night's bad sleep, is that a big deal, or should we be worrying about that?
Broadly, no. But if you probably have to consider it in context, if you're a person or an athlete who's had, let's say, months of bad sleep, and then they have a really bad night's sleep the night before a competition, the likelihood is that bad sleep is going to have an impact on that performance. Probably not because of that one night of bad sleep, but because of that block of bad sleep leading into it, which is quite common in sport, because obviously it's not just that one night before the competition where sleep can become disrupted, because we know that just a lead into an Olympic Games or a lead into a World Championships is fairly stressful, and there's lots of different things that happen in those weeks leading in. But generally, if you're a good sleeper and you have one night of bad sleep because you're, I don't know, your head's firing on all cylinders because you're thinking about the next day, about what time do I need to get up? Am I going to perform well? All these thoughts, which are completely expected around that time, the likelihood is that sleep probably isn't going to have a profound impact on your performance. It may have an impact on your mood, and it may have an impact on things like feelings of anxiety. So they may feel more intense. You may be a bit grumpy the next morning, but in terms of executing your performance, the likelihood it's going to be not that impacted by that one night of bad night's sleep.
So if we have one night's bad sleep, should we try and catch up the next day? Is it more about sleep over time or over days building up together? Or should we worry, you know, just about the actual night's sleep the night before a performance?
Yeah, it's a great question. It does work that way. So it is kind of accumulative. So if you're chopping off little bits of how much sleep you need each night over a period of time, you will accrue something what we call sleep debt. So you basically go into a deficit, which basically means that you're not getting as much sleep as you need to function at your best. Now, there's also a term called sleep credit, which I think is a great term. And I'm not sure these people exist, but they actually sleep more than they need. So you can actually go into sleep credit. So when you don't sleep well for, say, one night, and if you want to try and catch up, there is a temptation that you think, right, okay, I only slept for 4 hours last night. I need 8 hours to function. So the next night, I'm going to sleep for 12 hours because that way I'll go back to zero or back in the green. But sleep doesn't work like that. Fortunately, when you do go to sleep the next night after not sleeping well, your sleep will be much more intense. So the depth of your sleep will be much deeper, you'll sleep more soundly, and the quality will be much better. And you'll probably sleep slightly longer than you would have done, but you probably will recover that sleep. Maybe not after one night, but certainly after two nights, given the opportunity. So what I'm trying to say here is that it's not all about paying off sleep in terms of hours. Our brains have evolved to manage sleep so well, like unbelievably well, that it almost manages it on its own. So the key to it is almost giving your brains the opportunity to do its thing which is easier said than done, given everyone's busy lives and athletes' busy schedules. But the truth of the matter is that your brain can manage this on its own, which is quite a nice thing about sleep.
Are there different types of sleep? You mentioned about, you know, deep sleep, and I've heard, you know, 90-minute kind of cycles of sleep. Is that correct, or is that nonsense?
Yes, so there are what we call the architecture of sleep. So the temptation is just to look at it in terms of, again, hours and maybe quality. So people tend to talk about how long I slept for and whether it was good or bad. That's pretty much how the conversation goes. And of course, that's what people experience. People sort of tend to know how long they spend in bed because of what they see on a clock before they go to bed and when they wake up. And they have an experience on awakening about how they feel. So that sort of lends into that perception of, did I sleep good or bad? And that's actually a very good way of assessing your sleep. But what we don't see, which is the interesting bit, is the electrophysiology, which happens underneath the hood when you do fall asleep. So we know that by sort of measuring brain patterns and all sorts of electrical signals in the body, that your brain takes you into depths of sleep, starting out at shallow stages of sleep, going into deep stages of sleep, and then back up again into shallow, and then into sort of what we call REM sleep, or rapid eye movement sleep, which is sort of a very paradoxical stage of sleep, which we don't understand too much about, but it's there, so it's important. And that roughly takes 90 minutes on average, but it can range from like 80 to 110 minutes in different people. And that's what's called a cycle of sleep. And you can go through several cycles of sleep throughout the night. And that's what it looks like. But you don't really experience it. You experience the awakenings when you go into lighter stages of sleep, or you might experience deep sleep in the sense that if you've ever been woken up from deep sleep, you know about it because it feels like you've been hit by a bus. You feel so groggy. You feel really sort of lethargic. You can't really move your fingers properly. That's because you've been woken up from like a real low state of arousal, and it does take a bit of time for you to come out of that. But to go back to your question, yeah, you are breaking sleep into different cycles, different stages. But I find it fascinating that there's this whole like network of stuff that's happening when you close your eyes that we're not even aware of.
And is the 8-hour rule, is that an actual thing, or where does 8 hours sleep come from? That seems to be bandied about all the time as what we should be aspiring to get every night.
Well, basically there's like a bandwidth of how much sleep humans need, and it's between 7 and 9 hours. So it's basically a bell-shaped curve, if you want to describe it. So the majority of people on planet Earth will probably sleep for between 7 and 9 hours for a certain age, younger people requiring more sleep, and then adults requiring less sleep compared to young people. So that bandwidth, like I said, is 7 to 9 hours. The middle number of that is 8. So there's an assumption that everyone feels like they need to get 8 hours of sleep, but the reality is that most people will fall somewhere between 7 and 9. And the way that bell-shaped curves work, there's also going to be people that probably require less than 7 and more than 9.
So Luke, can you ever get too much sleep?
Yes, you can. I'd love to be in that position where I've got too much sleep, do you know what I mean? But yeah, it's the same analogy with food, really. Like, can you eat too much? Well, of course you can.
Sleeping doesn't make you fat, though, does it?
Well, indirectly, possibly, if you look at what sleep is, it's sedentary behaviour where you're just lying down for a long period of time. But yeah, I think that in athletes in particular, it's an interesting, really interesting question, because the sleep needs of athletes, if you sort of look at any black and white paper on this, suggests that athletes don't need 7 to 9 hours. They actually need more than that. They need like 9 to 10. And if you look at some big media figures that have spoken about this, like your Roger Federer's, LeBron James's, they sort of anecdotally say they sleep for 12 hours a day. And you get athletes that are trying to hit these targets because they think that's what successful sleep looks like. So you can certainly attempt to get too much sleep, which can lead to a whole host of different problems.
So what sort of problems could you get from too much?
So if you're attempting to get too much sleep, what basically that means is you're basically trying to schedule 12 to 13 hours of your day spent in bed. So if you actually did that on a bit of paper as an exercise, which I've done with athletes before, and try and work back from that and try and fit in life, training, obviously university work, if you're a younger athlete, it's near on impossible to fit it all in. But then you sort of scale back the question of, okay, what makes you think you need that amount of sleep? And then you realise quite quickly they've read something somewhere, or someone's told them that that's how much sleep they need. And then all of a sudden that conversation is open to, okay, let's try and let's experiment with this, because the beauty of sleep is that every night is an opportunity to learn. Like, you can do something slightly different in your approach or how you sleep, and the next morning you'll get some immediate feedback about how it went. So with some athletes, I've actually said, right, you're trying to spend 12 hours in bed here. We can see that you're only getting 6 hours of sleep. You're spending 6 hours of your time lying in bed doing absolutely nothing. You could probably be doing a lot more productive with your time than just lying there. How about we shorten that to say 7 hours in bed, and let's see how that goes. So you can attempt to get too much sleep by spending too long in bed. But if you sleep too much, which is possible, you can basically feel much more lethargic. You feel, again, like you're quite fatigued. It's quite a strange experience. You don't tend to experience in the day to days, because obviously you've got schedules that don't allow you to do this. But if anyone's ever been on holiday,
I can't remember what one of those is, but yeah, okay. If I've cast my mind back,
well, like, yeah, you take the sleep leash off and you can sort of sleep when you want, however long you want. You find yourself like having these naps in the daytime. You're also sleeping for long periods of time at night. And of course, you become this sort of lazy mess in the daytime just because you're like lounging around a lot. So it sort of plays into that. So there is a sweet spot where like alertness is the key here. So you want to sort of maintain alertness throughout the day. Going too far the other way can dampen that down, but not getting enough can also make that one probably a bit more hyperactive than you want it to be, but also can sort of lead to increased feelings of sleepiness, which can obviously affect that at the same time.
Okay, so if we take it to the other end of the spectrum and not getting enough sleep, what does that look like? And at what point do we classify somebody as an insomniac? Because I seem to have come into contact just recently with quite a few friends and colleagues, etc., who've mentioned the fact that they suffer with insomnia. At what point do you become insomniac, and what impact does that have on people?
Yeah, a great question. So the first thing to say is that sleep duration has got nothing to do with insomnia. So sleep duration is almost, you could argue, it's an outcome to how you sleep. So if you go to bed at a certain time, wake up at a certain time, and you sleep a certain way, the outcome is you'll sleep for a certain number of hours. Insomnia is the inability to fall asleep and stay asleep, which is, that's the experience of insomnia. And if you experience that for 3 times a week for more than 3 months, then by definition, you're sort of experiencing insomnia type symptoms. Obviously, if that length of time and frequency of symptoms increase, then obviously the more chronic and severe that becomes. So yeah, insomnia is more about their, like, despite spending X number of hours in bed, whether it's 10, 12, whatever, they just have this inability to fall asleep, or they wake up frequently in the night and they cannot fall back asleep. So that's what insomnia is, really.
And what impact does that have on the body? So prolonged kind of sleep deprivation.
Yeah, so it's, well, there's two sides to it in a way. So insomnia is obviously quite a stressful experience. So that's not really spoken about very much in terms of insomnia. So when you have these inabilities to fall asleep at night, it's highly frustrating when you're sort of lying there thinking, right, this is such a simple thing to do. I've been doing it since the day I was born. Everyone around me in the world is sleeping right now, but I can't do it. Like, that's a really stressful place to be, and you feel quite inadequate. And there's a cost to that in terms of how you are the next day, in terms of your well-being, your alertness. But the interesting thing with insomniacs, which again, isn't really spoken around in sort of more general terms, is that people with insomnia have this like heightened level of alertness, which makes them quite different in terms of me and you who are not. If you don't have insomnia and you don't sleep well, the next day you experience heightened levels of sleepiness, where given the opportunity, like, I don't know, listening to someone talk, watching TV, whatever, you might just nod off, fall asleep. Whereas some with insomnia, they don't really experience those symptoms of sleepiness. Their alertness levels just carry them through. They don't experience sleepiness in the same way. They just get tired over time, just because it's an exhausting process of having this inability to fall asleep coupled with this lack of sleep they're getting. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword. It does have a cost on the body and health and well-being in the future.
Right, so how do we all get better sleep? Top tips. I'll start with you, Laura, and then you can add in some some others, Luke?
I think one of the important things is understanding yourself. What do you need? So are you a morning person or are you an evening person? And you probably straight away be able to answer that. And then if you are an evening person, don't try and force yourself to go to bed at like 8, 9 o'clock in the evening, because that's just not what your kind of chronotype is. So work with what you've been gifted would be my advice. The environment is a big one for me. You know, is it the right temperature? Luke, what's the right temperature we might need?
I don't like putting a number to it, but it's like, yeah.
19?
Cool temperature.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, you don't want it absolutely roasting. You know, try and minimise kind of light. Just make sure you're comfortable as well. So one of the things we do when we travel abroad is, you know, if you do sleep better with your own pillow, take it with you. And then also, I suppose it's your interaction with your technology. Try and minimise that really close to bedtime. And then also, I do this a bit, and that is breathing. That for me, that's one thing that I can, if my mind's kind of busy and I need to kind of get to a place where I'm like in a good place to go to sleep, I'll do some kind of long, slow breathing. And that really helps me. But everyone's individual as well. So, and I'm going to pass over to Luke for his top tips.
The question I'd throw back is that when people say, oh, what can I do tonight to sleep well, would be, well, what do you mean by that? Do you want to fall asleep quickly? Do you want to sleep for a long time? Do you want to stay asleep all night? Do you want to wake up feeling refreshed? What is it? What do you want to achieve? Or what problem are you trying to solve? And once people sort of get to that place, then the things you do become a lot more targeted, a lot more specific, and much more likely to succeed. So more times than not, people say, oh, I want to be able to fall asleep quickly. Right, okay, let's solve that problem first. Then once we solve that problem, we can deal with the other stuff, which might come like second and third in the line. So if you want someone to fall asleep quickly, we know that sleepiness equals falling asleep quickly. So as you go through the day, your drive to sleep builds up. That's just how our brains work. So the longer you stay awake, the sleepier you feel. Actually, going to bed late isn't a bad thing if you are someone who wants to be able to fall asleep quickly. So it's the same analogy of like only go to bed when you feel sleepy. You wouldn't go to the fridge unless you feel hungry, or some people might, but I quite like that analogy. It's the same thing. We all sort of eat to hunger. We don't sleep to sleepiness. We just sort of sleep as and when we think we should sleep. We don't really listen to our bodies when it comes to that. So a lot of the sort of interventions that I try with athletes is like, hey, let's try and go to bed really late tonight and just see what happens. And they end up falling asleep really quickly. They don't get very much sleep. They complain that they haven't slept very well because they haven't got enough. And I'm like, well, you have slept well. You fell asleep quickly and you stayed asleep all night. We can solve the sleep duration problem a bit later. Let's just build your confidence and your ability to fall asleep first. And once we've got to that place, we can start introducing things to make you stay in bed for longer, but let's just solve that problem first. Sorry, that's quite a long-winded.
So you can, in effect, train an athlete to sleep better, like you can train them to sprint faster.
It's like babies. How do babies learn to sleep? They're trained. Yes, there's an innate physiology that they have to sleep, and babies sleep a lot, as do dogs, as I'm experiencing. But like I am now with my puppy, I'm training my puppy to sleep at a certain time of day for a certain length of time. That's the same with humans. We learn how to sleep. And I don't think that's appreciated enough, that sleep is a learnt behaviour. Yes, it's innate in all of us, but the bits around the edges we learn to do. And you can undo that learning as well.
So routine is extremely important, 100%. Like it would be with a baby. So it is kind of a learned,
definitely
habitual process.
Getting up at the same time of day, irrespective of what happened the night before, is the best way to ensure your sleep is regular. So if you have a bad night's sleep, still get up at the same time you normally would. You would feel a bit crappy for the rest of the day, but that next night you will fall asleep very quickly and you will sleep well, just because you haven't slept very well and sleep drive will be very high. So that's just how sleep works on a day-to-day basis. And when I was in Tokyo, whenever all the athletes were saying like, oh, I'm experiencing jet lag, and I'm like, okay, how's your sleep? And they go, well, I've had a bad night's sleep, then I had a good night's sleep, then I had a bad night's sleep. I was like, well, okay, that's sleep drive in action. You've got short sleep followed by long sleep followed by short sleep. And that's just how our brains are managing our sleep. Just because that's just how it is. So you can use that to your advantage, but understanding that is the key. Once you understand that process, all these doors start to open up for you because you just know how this works.
Absolutely. I've got to get up at 7 tomorrow morning, having slept terribly last night. So when we are, you know, traveling across multiple time zones, Luke, is it actually possible to beat jet lag? So what were some of your strategies in Tokyo? Like, what did you get the athletes to do?
Is it possible to beat jet lag? I would say no.
I would concur.
If you want to beat jet lag, take a boat to Tokyo. It'll take you about 3 months, but you won't get jet lag. Basically, our bodies aren't designed to be thrown across the world so quickly. Jet lag happens to everyone. As much as people say, I don't get jet lag, they do. How much people complain about it or how much people experience it is a slightly different question. But physiologically, it's basically a mismatch of clocks. So your body clock is saying a certain time and the social clock, which we see on our walls, is saying another time. So when you're in the UK, those should be roughly the same. When you travel to another country, they become out of sync. My role is basically to how do I line those clocks as quickly as possible, given the considerations of when sport's first major event is going to be, when's the first significant training session going to be. And how you manage that is actually quite tricky, because the main thing that drives jet lag isn't necessarily sleep. It's actually a problem, like I said, of clocks being misaligned. And the one thing that regulates our body clocks is light exposure. That is what keeps you ticking at the same time of day. So when we get to Tokyo, there's a real sort of specific package of light exposure, which doesn't sound particularly fancy, but the art of it is aligning that abilities to go outside and get sunlight, particularly if you're an indoor sport where it's quite easy just to spend days in a hotel and then go into your training venue and back again. Particularly in Tokyo, where we weren't actually allowed to go outside very much, the ability to actually just get natural light exposure was actually a huge challenge. So I did a lot of work with sports prior to going to the games, is trying to align these things better. So how do you align training schedules, other things that are in the schedule, with things like, have you got opportunities to go outside and get light exposure? And if you don't, what are alternative ways of doing that? So we introduce things like artificial light boxes or SAD lamps, you might have referred them to, which are basically just iPad sized things which shine like 10,000 lux of light in your face, which is quite intense if you haven't done it before. But that's a really potent stimulus to tell the body clock that it's daytime when it might be saying it's nighttime.
Right. So I want to, having learned all that, I want to just bust some myths around sleep, which sounds like there are a lot out there and that you're doing that very readily with athletes. So this is going to be a quick fire round. Are you ready?
Ready.
Booze, it helps you sleep. Is that a myth?
Yes. I think broadly it's a myth.
Broadly. Okay. Laura, coffee definitely keeps you awake.
Yeah, there's different levels of caffeine, but that's a stimulant. So it basically makes you be, or tries to make you be alert.
Okay, so who wants this one? Cheese gives you nightmares.
I'd say myth.
It doesn't matter when you sleep, as long as you sleep.
Myth.
And this is one from my mother, actually. An hour before midnight, so an hour before 12 p.m. is worth 2 hours after.
Myth, unfortunately. Sorry, Mum.
Oh, Mum. Fantastic. You've both been an absolute dream. Pun definitely intended. Thank you so much for joining us, and sleep well tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks to you for listening as well. If you want to continue the conversation about anything we've discussed in this podcast, you can get in touch with us on social media at EIS to Win. Don't forget to check out our website and YouTube channel for more great content from the English Institute of Sport. Coming up next time, we'll be talking about retirement, how the EIS can help athletes come to terms with life away from sport, and what it can teach all of us about embracing change. That's on the way in the next episode of the EIS Insider. Speak to you then.